I speak for the kids who don't have the same voice that I do. And I think biggest thing is through education, because you're not born racist. You're born, racism is taught. You know, if you can educate yourself on different things and have the proper education, no matter where you live, no matter how much money you have, I think the biggest thing, that's one thing I feel like can help propel us to a better world. And I feel like we can talk about the voting and police reform we can do now, but education and our future with the kids, I think that's one thing that can really help, you know, like I said, propel us to where we need to be as a country.
Mitchell continuing to be such a leading voice on social justice issues, taking on that burden, even though he is just still a few days shy of his 24th birthday. Welcome to The Jump. I'm Rachel Nichols. Today, I am joined by our front office insider, Amin El Hassan, and our senior writer, host of the Low Post podcast. Welcome to Zach Lowe as well. Coming up, Mitchell and Jamal Murray have each scored at least 50 points twice in their series. With Game 7 tonight on ABC, is it fair to expect anything close to that kind of output? We will discuss that. First, though, so ever since this Rockets-Thunder series locked as a first-round matchup, Chris Paul has objected to portraying it as some sort of vengeance mission, which is smart. I mean, why add an additional emotional element to a matchup that was already going to be hard enough? But whether Chris himself wants to acknowledge this is an opportunity for payback, the facts are the facts. The Rockets traded him last summer because they thought Russell Westbrook would be better for them. And they believe that so strongly, they were willing to pay a great price to make the swap, sending not just CP to the Thunder, but also two future first-round picks and two pick swaps. That is a huge bet on Westbrook over Paul, and at least so far in this series, that bet is not paying off in the Rockets' favor. Russ didn't even play in the first four games due to a quad injury, and while that is hardly his fault, it's relevant since one of the knocks on Chris in Houston was that he was too injury-prone. Fast forward to Game 5, Russ was back, but clearly rusty, chipping in just 7 points. And then last night in Game 6, yeah, wasn't great. In the game's final 6 minutes, Westbrook airballed a jumper. Then he missed a layup. Whew. Even more costly, he kept coughing up the ball. Ross would end the night with 7 turnovers, 2 of which came down the stretch. There was this one with the score tied and just 1:23 on the clock. And then this, Houston down 2, just 12.9 seconds remaining. The Rockets had the ball, the chance to either send the game to overtime or win it outright. Except instead of making sure James Harden had a chance to shoot, Russ drove toward the basket, met a bunch of traffic, and threw a wild pass to Robert Covington that he really had no chance of catching. Dennis Schroeder, well, he appeared to be amused at that one. Now I want to note, Russ was not the only one who faltered late for Houston. James Harden had 5 turnovers himself in this game, and despite 32 points on the night, he was passive at game's end, only shooting twice in the final 4 minutes, and that's counting a last-second desperation heave. Still, it's hard not to focus on Russ, since the guy they traded away to get him was, once again, just so damn exceptional in the clutch. Chris Paul scored 8 of OKC's final 12 points, including these back-to-back threes on Covington when OKC was down 6. Now, on his way back up the court, Chris actually slapped Covington on the butt, which was amazing. Then with 13 seconds left, Chris hit the 2 go-ahead free throws, finishing off a masterpiece of a night that also included 0 turnovers despite playing 40 minutes. Now, the internet, of course, went nuts. LeBron James put some respect on his name and more. C.J. McCollum chimed in. So did Ja Morant. Now, Chris himself was more circumspect after the game. He talked about the Thunder, who, after having to pack their suitcases pregame for possible travel out of the bubble, could now go back to the hotel and unpack for a few more days. He talked about a Game 7 and how exciting it was, no matter who the opponent is. But even if this is, in fact, not revenge for CP, it certainly is vindication. Because win or lose this series, he has made it clear, quote, upgrading from Chris Paul, that is a tough bet. So, I mean, it's official. We have another Game 7. Complete this sentence for me. The Thunder win Game 7 if what?
Thunder win Game 7 if Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Danilo Gallinari show up and have good games as they did in Game 6, or for most of Game 6, I should say. If you look down the stretch, all those shots that Chris Paul hit, they were tough shots. They were tough shots because the Rockets' defense was locked and loaded and waiting, and there really was not a whole high respect factor for the other offensive players on the floor. So I think one of the things that they need to have better spacing is for that, is so that Chris Paul can have the room to drive and not fear being collapsed upon or have to hit these crazy, unbelievable deep three-pointers to be a hero.
I'll go this. The Thunder win game seven if, A, it's close. Apparently, they're just unbeatable in close games as long as the point guard is on the floor. B, they keep Houston off the line. For a team with James Harden on it to have a free throw late rate that would have been last in the regular season, that is phenomenal foul avoidance by the Thunder. And C, I'll give you another name to watch. If Eric Gordon can't find his game, the jumper is totally broken, the turnovers, he's throwing the ball all over the court. If he can't find his game and it's close, the Thunder have a real shot and Houston's in trouble. And if Houston loses this game, make no mistake, as Rachel implied, it's an organizational disaster.
Yeah, Eric Gordon certainly not a fan favorite on Rockets Twitter right now. And guys, as I mentioned at the top of the show, it was rough down the stretch in Game 6 for both Rockets superstars. So who, Zach, did you say disappointed you more late in that game last night? Was it Russ or was it James Harden?
I'm going to go with James Harden because at least Russell Westbrook tried to do stuff. Now, that's not really fair to James Harden because he made two great hustle plays, including that save late in the game. But there was a moment with about a minute and 20 left before one of those Russ turnovers where Robert Covington had the ball on the left wing and James Harden was up top with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander on him. And Robert Covington looked at James like, hey, man, can you maybe, like, flash a little bit? Because I don't really want to be dribbling out here. And James just stood there like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do anything. You got to pass the ball to somebody else. You're James Harden. You think you should win the MVP every single year, and you have justification for that. Go get the ball. Act like you want the ball. Now, you don't have to take every shot, but you can't just be a bystander for the last 3 or 4 minutes of the game.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree. I'm going to say it's Russ. I think Russ, first of all, you know, the last 5 minutes of the game was just poor decision-making, poor execution. It's kind of the polar opposite of what Chris Paul was doing. When you look at the shot selection, when you look at the turnovers that he had down the stretch, this is kind of the story of Russell Westbrook in the playoffs. He's a guy that if things are a wide-open game, he's great. But when we get to taking care of the ball on a possession-by-possession basis, not as good. The other thing that Russ does, and we don't talk about enough, his lack of shooting makes it so hard for James Harden out there. He shrunk the court there because if you watch on all those possessions where James had to take a step back or James was driving or whatever, they're sagging off Russ completely. They have no respect for him. They're going under on the screens. And by the way, this is why before the series started, I had Thunder in six. And then when I heard Russ was hurt, I was like, ah, it's going to help the Rockets because he's not going to be out there to kind of mess up the spacing.
Amin, come on. I do think, though, look.
I'm dead serious.
I know you are, and your point certainly speaks to, again, what I was saying at the top of the show, and Zach says organizational failure. You knew about Russ's shooting when you got him. You knew, you did all, I mean, this is the most analytics-oriented front office. They knew all the information before they made this trade. And by the way, this is not a referendum per se on the trade, because if James Harden didn't want to play with Chris Paul anymore, that is an additional factor that no number, right? That no number can account for. So I am not necessarily saying, oh man, the front office, they really screwed up here. I am just saying this is where this possibly went wrong for Houston, and we will find out over the next couple days. But if organizationally you felt like you had to make the trade because of what James Harden did or didn't want or what he was comfortable playing with, man, you gave up for a lot for a guy who his counterpart that you traded away is just shining in this series. All right, guys, coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about Giannis Antetokounmpo. He said after last night's game that he didn't ask to switch on Jimmy Butler and would just continue to execute his coach's game plan. Should he have asked to switch on Jimmy? He is the Defensive Player of the Year. Stick around more for that. First, though, here is the latest edition of The Jump at the Symphony, today starring Jimmy Butler. Maestro?
Six to shoot. Butler sizes up hill. And hits again. He has put Miami on his back.
The Jump is brought to you by Heineken. Enjoy Heineken responsibly.
Cue me in, do the clapping, and be like, action. It's a make or miss league.
Maybe a little more funny than that.
I don't know what am I make or missing? It's a make or miss league. Cut that.
Oh, Jimmy. Let's check out today's Make or Miss, brought to you by Michelob Ultra. Make swim class. Earlier in the year, we showed you Taco Fall learning how to swim. And, well, he's continuing the education in the bubble. Here is Jaylen Brown and Enes Kanter helping him out. Zach, will he one day be Taco the Torpedo?
Hey, this is great teamwork. It's great teamwork. And it's never too old to learn stuff. You're never too old to learn to swim. You're never too old to learn to bike. I love the team chemistry. Great teamwork. Good effort, Taco.
It's a hell of a workout for Jaylen Brown and Enes Kanter. Jeez. You guys got playoff games to worry about.
Producer Steve said this morning, why does he need to learn to swim? He just stands anywhere he wants in the ocean. It's true. There you go. Make contributions. 23-year-old Bam Adebayo dropping an easy 12, 17, and 6. And 2 in yesterday's win. Zach, how much better hit can he get? That stat line just keeps going.
That's the scary thing. You know those two little mid-range jumpers Bam hit in the fourth quarter? Mm-hmm. Imagine when that becomes a more automatic shot for him. Then he can pump fake. Then his drive game opens up a little bit. Bam's got a long way to go, as good as he is before his ceiling, and that is scary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going with that. So when he hit the jump shot, I was like, come on, man. Like, you got to have something that we got to be able to say, let him do that.
I mean, everyone keeps saying, oh, he's like this player, he's like that player, but I feel like everyone we compare him to, he has the potential, just in style, to be a little bit better than, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he's like in-shape Draymond.
Right, well, that's what everyone says. He's like Draymond, but he's physically, he's got a little bit more physicality than Draymond. All right, Miss Posterity. We've got another shot below the belt last night. That is the third one of this series. You can see the pain on Russell Westbrook's face. Nobody wants that. Nobody. I mean, over under 5 grunt shots in game 7. Sorry, it's a half.
But what? Can I ask?
I wanted to say 5.
Can I ask why? Because I used to think, like, oh, maybe it's because Chris Paul's little and when he flails, it just happens to be in that area. But I'm like, we've had a lot of little players in the league. We haven't had this many crotch shots with any one player. Just get it out of the game, man.
Under. Let's have a nice, clean game 7. Or let's go the other way and go straight Ric Flair uppercuts.
That's
all over
the floor.
That's
what I was going for with the 5.
0, nice, clean game.
I'm saying I expect it to be scrappy. Make family business. Families are in the bubble, guys. Look at Fred VanVleet welcoming his kiddos. This was so sweet. This didn't get you yesterday on social media. You have no heart. And later we see Giannis's partner and his newborn. I mean, this is some good news in 2020. We needed this, right? They got to be courtside. Look at little baby.
Yeah.
He is so cute.
Yeah, shout out to Mariah, by the way. I worked for her at Summer League a long time ago. Look, for Fred VanVleet, I'm really interested in this. Because last year, if you remember, before he had a kid, he was struggling. Kid comes out of the mama, all of a sudden he hits every shot. So are we going to see the same thing happen this year?
Hey, I'm not in the bubble. Never been in the bubble. Don't really want to go in the bubble. But by all accounts, a little touch of home might go a long way for these guys.
Yeah, no
I like
doubt.
How Jimmy said it's here for a business trip.
Well, he's got a new baby, newish baby, so there is a little bit difference there. And by the way, you said shout out to Mariah, which is certainly true, Giannis's partner, but shout out to all of the wives, girlfriends, family members who had to go through quarantine. You were talking about having to go through a quarantine where you're staying in the same hotel room, cannot leave, with young children. And if anybody has spent time around young children, you know that is an accomplishment that is greater than what any of these guys are doing on the court. Just saying. All right, we mentioned
Absolutely.
Giannis. We will stay with the Bucks and Heat as game 1 of that series definitely did not disappoint, guys. Jimmy Butler went off for a playoff career high.
Ooh.
40 points, including 15 in the fourth quarter. Butler said of his late game mindset, quote, I told my teammates I probably wasn't going to pass them the ball. I made a couple shots and they said, that's fine with me. Butler even had his former teammate, Joel Embiid, tweeting about him, posting a cryptic if. I'm not sure how cryptic that is. No. We all know what the end of that sentence was. Followed by Jimmy Butler, too good. I'm sure Sixers fans won't be worried about that at all, guys. After the game, Defensive Player of the Year, Giannis Antetokounmpo, was asked about taking on the defensive assignment of Jimmy Butler, and here is what he said.
Did you ask Bud to take Jimmy late? To guard him?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. Why would you ask that?
Is that something you want to do going forward?
No, I'll do whatever coach tells me to do.
So that's interesting. Zach, what do you make of Giannis's response there?
Well, look, I feel like I'm living Groundhog Day. Didn't we have this exact same conversation last year? Why can Kawhi Leonard guard Giannis and be the number one option for the Raptors, but Giannis can't do the same thing for the Bucks? It's just sort of strange to me. I get he's a great help defender. You want him around the basket. But Jimmy Butler is eating your lunch, your dinner, your breakfast for one possession, for two possessions. Take that crazy wingspan, envelope Jimmy Butler, and see how those little 17-footers feel for him now. I don't understand why it doesn't happen. I don't understand why Giannis apparently can't play more than 35, 36 minutes in a playoff game until their backs are literally against the wall. I just don't get it. I'm kind of tired of having this conversation, to be honest.
You know, Rachel, we played a bunch of clips of Jimmy driving and Jimmy dunking and Jimmy doing all these things. How many of those things did he do over a double team? How many of those things did he do against any duress other than one-on-one? Right. This league, it is so incredibly difficult to guard superstars one-on-one. And make no mistake, yes, you, Dan Le Batard, Jimmy Butler is a superstar. You guard him one-on-one, this is going to happen time and time again. You got George Hill guarding him. George Hill's a good defensive player. He's also 6'3". I mean, these are just mismatches for the guy. These are all straight drives. He's not seeing any help there, and which is the really weird thing, which is Milwaukee has prided itself all year long on, we don't give up the paint. We'll give up as many threes as we want. But they walked into that game, and they're scared of the Miami Heat's three-point shooting, to the point where they let Jimmy Butler run haywire one-on-one all the way to the paint.
Well, it will be interesting to see what adjustments they make for game two. Coach Budenholzer was asked about this today, and he said that certainly, he said, it is a consideration and a discussion about whether Giannis would guard Jimmy Butler. Now, guys, we know that Bud has been criticized in the past for not making adjustments during playoff series, so we'll have to see what he decides to do there. This matchup, I think, is going to be good. I mean, I can see this going seven games for sure. Definitely going to be spicy, so I'm excited about this one. Here's what the Jump recommends for today. I'm excited about this, too. Our own Zach Lowe. Anyone know that guy? He penned a column for ESPN.com looking ahead to Game 7 between the Jazz and the Nuggets. Is it fair to expect the scoring binge from Jamal Murray and Donovan Mitchell to continue tonight? We will discuss that right after the break. Do your reading during the commercial and then come back with us. We'll be here in a few minutes.
Murray inside, incredible. Mitchell, nasty.
This one's starting to feel like a heavyweight fight. Mitchell's got 50.
Yeah, what, 57?
And that might be the dagger. Wow. And the Denver Nuggets send this one to a game seven.
Jamal had 50, man. Like, we got to give him credit, but we got one more game. In life, you find things that hold value to you, and things to fight for. And we found something worth fighting for.
What a performance. And we're going to see it again. Game seven.
Oh, man, this is going to be good. Coming up later today, we'll have two more NBA playoff matchups for you. First, Game 2 of Celtics-Raptors at 5:30 Eastern on ESPN. Then, over on ABC, it's Game 7 between Jamal Murray and the Nuggets and Donovan Mitchell and the Jazz. Our coverage tip with NBA Countdown at 5 o'clock Eastern. Welcome back right here to The Jump. I'm Rachel Nichols, still here with Amin El-Hassan, Zach Lowe. The Nuggets-Jazz, this series has been insane, guys. Highlighted by the scoring prowess of Jamal Murray, Donovan Mitchell, both players have recorded multiple 50-point games in this series, matching the number of players with multiple 50-point games in a series in all of postseason history entering 2020. All of postseason history, Murray and Mitchell can become the first players with three 50-point games in a single postseason tonight. So, Zach, after everything they've done in this series, is it fair to expect another epic duel tonight, or are we going to get that Game 7 everyone's exhausted thing?
Is it fair to expect them to score 100 points combined on, like, infinity shooting? Rach, my head says no, but my heart says please, let's just see it one more time. Probably not, but I will say this. If they start hot, if either of them starts hot, I expect to see a little more pressure, a couple of traps here and there, and I expect both defenses to try and say, boy, if you're still on fire, we're taking the ball out of your hands. So I think the scoring totals will come down. But then again, I thought Jamal Murray wouldn't score 50 again, so who the hell knows?
Right.
You know, Zach, it's funny because I was thinking to myself, We had six games of this, and they still haven't trapped anybody or tried to get the ball out of their hands. You're going to start now in game seven? No, we're going to have another duel. Shoot it out. Disco Vietnam. Let's do this, baby.
These guys are so much fun, and also just knowing that they are going to be going at each other like this in the West for years. It just adds another layer to this as you watch this tonight. It is win or go home for both teams. They both have to have all their stuff packed before they go to the arena. This is amazing. And one team is going to have to leave the bubble, and the other team is going to get to stay, probably transfer to a different hotel. So it's win or go home tonight. Amin, who you got in this game?
This is as much of a coin flip as you can get. I think I'm going to go with the Denver Nuggets, though, for this reason. I think both of those guys, Mitchell and Murray, are going to give us a show. So it's going to come down to who's the other guy? Who's going to step up? On one hand, in Denver, I've got an all-star, all-NBA center who actually played really well in Game 6. We just don't remember it because Jamal Murray was out of his mind.
Right.
On the other hand, in Utah, I got a bunch of guys who are okay guys, but not on that caliber. I'm going Denver.
I'm with Amin. This is a complete coin flip. I have no idea, but I'll contrast this. I trust Utah's defense and overall shooting a little bit more than Denver, but I trust Denver's depth more than Utah's, and Denver has a second star in Nikola Jokic who can go off for 30, 35. So to me, it is a coin flip, but I'm leaning a little bit Utah. I think they're a little embarrassed by what's happened the last couple of games, and they'll come out and play a better defensive game, continue to hit threes. I don't feel great about it, but you're forcing me. You're forcing me, so I'm going Utah.
I am Zach Lowe, and this is another fascinating example in the bubble where home court advantage would have made a big difference in the way you guys talked about this last game, right? Would have been in Denver at altitude in front of the Nuggets home fans. They're not going to have any of that tonight, so I do wonder if that's going to give the Jazz a little bit more of a fighting chance. Who do you think the Clippers are going to be sitting there watching TV tonight? Who do you think they want to face in the next round? Because they're the next team up for whichever team wins this series. What do you think, Amin?
Ooh, that's a good question. Another coin flip.
I think maybe
they'd rather face Denver.
You think so? How come?
Yeah, because they can't defend. Because they don't defend, right? Because at least Utah has the potential to defend. Denver has accepted, look, we're not going to defend. We did it once last year. It was all right. Now we're going back to letting anybody do whatever they want. I think with the Clippers, you're in for much more of a slugfest if you're going against Utah.
I think the Clippers are going to be big favorites no matter who gets through. But if I were them, I think I might root for the Jazz only because they're getting pretty thin. They're down to seven guys, and even that's kind of a stretch. They might be a little tired. Denver's getting Gary Harris back. They'd be coming in with momentum. Yeah. They have two scoring stars. I think I might prefer Utah, but I don't think the Clippers are like that worried either way.
They're rooting for a seven overtime game.
Right, Rachel. Yes.
Seven overtimes. Knock yourselves out.
And you know, I'm sure Kawhi Leonard will just be tweeting through the whole game like he always does, expressing to us exactly what he's thinking in every moment. So we have that looking forward to us, too. All right, coming up, Michael Wilbon and J.A. Adande are going to join me. We are going to discuss the life and legacy of a man that the three of us knew so well and impacted us to such a degree. I'm not even sure one segment's going to be enough, but we're going to try the legacy of Coach John Thompson. Up next on The Jump, Michael Wilbon and J.A. Adande.
You know, really hard right now. He was one of a kind. There's nobody like John Thompson. He brought change to college basketball. He empowered a lot of African-American coaches and kids to come in and be the best you can be. I mean, they talk about Mount Rushmore of coaches, and John Thompson is on it.
A guy you have to appreciate, especially, you know, for me and, you know, other young Black African-American guys. You know, he's one of the guys who paved the way for so many of us.
Coach was more than a mentor to me. He was a teacher, a father figure, not just to me, for so many of us who got a chance to play for him.
What he did off the court for not just his community, but for the African-American community and for Georgetown is remarkable.
You know what? I came to love the man. We should remember John for a lot of things. Great basketball, great person, for all he did of standing up and talking about issues that need to be talked about.
Welcome back to The Jump. You know, I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. It's a place where you would routinely see presidential motorcades driving down the street on your way to get ice cream. You could get pretty casual about a lot of very famous and important people, but there was one guy who remained a god to all of us, no matter who you were, and that man was John Thompson. To say he was a giant is doing a disservice to his stature. To say he was a Hall of Fame basketball coach is a disservice to his impact, which went way beyond the court. And to say that there was sadness when his family announced yesterday he had passed at age 78, yeah, that does not nearly cover it. Where do you start with John Thompson? Well, you could talk about the way he took a sleepy average basketball program and made it into a national powerhouse, how he helped develop Patrick Ewing, the anchor for the Hoyas 1984 championship team. That title made Thompson the first black head coach to win a men's D1 basketball championship. It was a see-it-be-it moment for young coaches all over the country. But it was his emphasis on education that really resonated. 78 of the players he coached went all 4 years at Georgetown. 76 of those 78, 97% of them, went on to graduate. Thompson cared about his players and wasn't afraid to take a stand in their defense. Like in January of 1989, Thompson walked off the court before a game against Boston College. This was in protest of an NCAA vote to deny athletic scholarships to freshmen who didn't qualify academically. It was estimated that about 90% of the 600 students who would have been affected each year would be black, which Thompson would not stand for. That day, he told the Washington Post, quote, "This is my way of bringing attention to a rule a lot of people weren't even aware of. I did it to bring attention to the issue in hopes of getting the NCAA to take another look at what they've done. And if they feel it unjust, change the rule." Again, not afraid to take action to force change. This is why his former players loved him so much. Here's Allen Iverson on Thompson at his Hall of Fame induction speech in 2016.
I want to thank Coach Thompson for saving my life. For giving me the opportunity. An incident happened in high school. No other teams, no other schools were recruiting me anymore. My mom went to Georgetown and begged him to give me a chance. And he did.
Wow. Other former players weighing in on losing Thompson yesterday, Patrick Ewing, who is, of course, the current head coach of the Hoyas, saying, quote, "Georgetown University, the sport of basketball, and the world has lost someone who I consider to be a father figure, confidant, and role model." Another Hall of Famer coached by Thompson, Alonzo Mourning, said, quote, "The world has lost a revolutionary icon and a leader. Today I have lost a father figure, lifelong coach, and one of my greatest mentors. Coach Thompson saved my life." This time I would like to welcome two people who knew John Thompson well, my friends, former Washington Post colleagues, longtime columnist, now director of sports journalism at the prestigious Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, J.A. Adonde, and of course, the co-host of PTI, the legend, Michael Wilbon. Guys, thank you so much for being here. We were all texting yesterday just about Big John. And Wilbon, can you start with the legacy of John Thompson?
Well, Rachel, you know what's interesting now, watching all the coverage and watching some of the clips you just had leading into our segment, Allen Iverson is so much of it. And the story is unbelievable. Allen Iverson and that story are still compelling. And most of all, for people, say, under 45 years old, it's memorable. But that was the end of the John Thompson time at Georgetown, or close to it. He retired in 1999. Iverson was there in 95 and 96. That's the back end. For those of us old enough who were here in the 1980s covering Georgetown and around a lot, there's so much more. Patrick Ewing isn't even the beginning. You know, Sleepy Floyd and a whole slew of players, John Duren and Craig Shelton. John Thompson had taken Georgetown to the Elite Eight before Patrick Ewing got there. And then Patrick Ewing comes and, yes, it vaults them into the national spotlight in the context of the Big East. But John's legacy to me deals with education and sports as much as anything. You talked about the protest and walking out of that game, which I attended low many years ago. It was about education and what it is that kids would need. Remember, I know you and J.A. both know this. He had that deflated basketball in his office. And the deflated basketball was there because it was a reminder that it's not always going to bounce, that you're going to have to do something else. And John hated the phrase fall back on education, which is why I came to hate it so much. You don't fall back on education. You use it every day. And to hear John Thompson was so demanding. I mean, he could be warm and fuzzy when he wanted to, which was sort of rarely, because he knew he needed to prod and he needed to instigate and he needed to force and cajole. And sometimes you say, well, John did a week, he'd say, shut up, don't tell, I don't want people knowing I'm that nice. We don't need that. We're trying to get through something here. Jay knows these stories. And so his legacy to me is all these things. It's from before Patrick, through Allen Iverson. It was national. It was the Georgetown clothes on the streets and cities where they didn't even know what Georgetown was or where it was. And so all of these things John Thompson brought to the table. John, look, I never played for John Thompson. I didn't play college basketball, but John Thompson coached the hell out of me for 40 years.
Yep.
I texted that to Patrick Ewing this morning, and Patrick laughed and texted me back, and he knew what I was talking about, because if you were around him, the seriousness, the gravity of the conversations, the depth, the intellect of the man, all of these things are his legacy. And you know, for me, Rach, I mean, 30% of it may be basketball. So much of it doesn't relate necessarily directly to basketball, even though that's the arena and that's the context.
It's amazing when you say he coached you, even though he didn't actually coach you. Jay, I know you feel the same way. One of the things you said to me yesterday was, everything I do, I feel like, is John Thompson going to approve of this or not? Is that a big part of how you're going to remember him?
Absolutely. The legacy to me is that not only was he the first African-American coach to win the NCAA tournament, but he used that status and he used the job security that that provided to lead the way and to speak up for other Black coaches in particular who didn't have that power, who maybe were on a shakier status. He would tell them, and Mike and I were at these meetings, all the Black coaches and Black sports writers would get together at the Final Four, and he'd tell the other coaches, I'll take the lead on this, I'll take the hits. He had the confidence, he had the strong relationship with his superiors at Georgetown, that he knew nothing was going to happen to him. He could walk off a court to draw attention to matter, and he wasn't going to lose his job. So it's not just that he had the pulpit. He used it to help others. And, yes, he taught me, Rachel, just as much as he taught Rachel. A lot of the perceptions and the notions I have of equality come from him.
Absolutely. I mean, I can hear his voice as we're sitting here talking about him. You wanted his approval so badly. I know I did. And when he would bestow it, it would mean the absolute world. And we're looking right now at NBA players and this incredible movement that they have been such a big part of. Well, but how is that something that John Thompson was really one of the great forefathers of pointing out not just inequality right in front of people's faces, but what got you there, especially with the educational differences that were offered to African Americans that he saw coming into his program versus some of the white kids that he saw coming in, and what opportunities they had in elementary school, junior high, and high school that weren't being offered to a lot of his other players?
Well, the shortcomings, that's what Big John was always trying to highlight. It's like, I'm not worried. We're not dealing with test scores now, present day.
Yep.
Why are these scores where they are? And what do they denote? How do we know what they mean? Does it mean that kids, once they're allowed to have the means to play catch up and do, does it mean they shouldn't be in this university, in this situation, in a 4-year situation, being able to play? What is it that made those scores where they are? And how do we change that? And again, I cannot stress enough, Rachel, and you guys know this, but I don't know how much listeners do. They see a basketball coach. But those guys, and Alonzo Mourning is one of the most eloquent people when it comes to speaking to this, to the result of that education. 4 years, by the way. There were no one and dones. Allen Iverson went for 2 years, and the world was changing then, and John understood that. But Patrick Ewing, Dikembe Mutombo was funded. He's created hospitals.
Yep.
This is outside of basketball. And so John was looking at the inequities. How do we change this? And how do I protect mine in the process of this being changed? How do we not abandon them while the world is playing catch up? And it wasn't just basketball. It was, like I said, it was all of us. You know, John, when Jay says John would take the hit, John Thompson literally would say, you younger guys who might have been Black coaches, shut up. This was a great phrase he said. He'd say, how Black are you? How black can you afford to be right now? And it obviously, it didn't mean how black you were. It was how secure are you? You know, and it came that way to even writers writing columns, writing pieces. John would say, really, you're going to write that? Are you sure that your news organization is going to let you be that black this week? And so that sort of, he was reminding people that there was more than obligation. That if you were going to answer this, you better be rooted deeply enough and firmly enough that you could go out there and swing that bat and make it work.
Jay, you teach college-age students every day now. What do you want the kids in your classes, and frankly, a lot of the NBA players are those same ages, right? 20, 21, 22, 23, 4 years old. What do you want them to remember and know about John Thompson?
That he taught me, and that we can continue that legacy through his words. One of the ways that he defined inequality was he said, we want the right to fail. We don't want the right to succeed. We want the right to fail. He shouldn't have had to have been a national championship winning coach to have his voice carry as much weight as it did. There were several white coaches whose words we took seriously who had nowhere near the accomplishments of him. So that's what he talked about, the right to fail. And I realized one of the reasons he was so effective at getting his message across was because he didn't whine about the inequalities that he faced. He would always say, I find it amusing. And when he said amusing, just like when Michael Jordan said, okay, fine, it wasn't really fine. When John Thompson said amusing, it meant that he didn't find it humorous.
Not at all.
It meant that he was pointing something out, such as, for example, there was some talk that he might go to the NBA in the mid-90s. And the word was that, oh, he wants general manager powers and he wants final say in personnel decisions. He's a control freak. He would point out, they call me a control freak. But then, meanwhile, what happened? John Calipari, Larry Brown, these college coaches went to the NBA, and what did they have? They had personnel say, unlike John Thompson. John Thompson was considered a control freak. Other coaches were not. And he would just point that out. And just leave it at that and leave it for you to fill in the rest of the sentence.
I do want to point out, too, that while John Thompson always fought so hard for people who looked like him, it wasn't only for people who looked like him. If he thought that you were someone who was a minority in your field, if he thought you were someone who was fighting for a fair chance, he would go out of his way to be in your corner. That was something with me when I started in the Washington market. We had, of course, the great Christine Brennan, but there weren't that many other women who were around at these sporting events. And very early on, he found me, and very early on, he would have these talks with me and say, you belong here. And I can't tell you what that means when you look around a room and you don't look like everyone else and you think, oh, am I really supposed to be here? And I know you guys both felt that way, too.
Rachel, just to add to that point about John being different and being way ahead. So Lori Michael, a name known only here in Washington and you guys, of course, because you cover the team. John Thompson had a head trainer who was a young woman on his bench 40 years ago.
Yes.
His academic advisor. She wasn't an advisor. The academic dictator, Mary Finlan, was with him 50 years ago, back to when he was in high school. This wasn't a sort of a movement that John said, I need to hire a woman. There was somebody he saw that he knew he was great, and she was getting hired. And it didn't matter what anybody at Georgetown thought, or the Big East, or the NCAA, or the Washington Post, or New York Times, anywhere else. This is what John was doing 40 years ago. And so now it's interesting when you talk about women being on the bench, you know, in NBA situations. Yes, now it's coach and it's moved along. Again, one more time, 40 years ago, or real close to it.
Absolutely. You know, we have a little group of people here at ESPN who either grew up or worked in the Washington area for a long time. You guys, of course, we know Scott Van Pelt, our friend Sean Trey, who works as a talent producer. I know everybody was so hit by this. If you're from that part of the country and all through the basketball world, we celebrate the life of John Thompson. Wilbon, Dande, thank you guys both so much for being with me here today. We're going to stop talking about him right now, but I swear we will remember him always. He is never going to go away. That voice is with us. He was 78 years old.
I told the kids.
Don't you forget about that, Rachel. Don't you forget it.
Oh, I can hear it right now. Everyone at The Jump would like to send our condolences to the Thompson family. We're going to miss you a lot, Coach. We really are.
The Jump is brought to you by Heineken. Enjoy Heineken responsibly.
Tomorrow, we've got two more NBA playoff matchups for you on ESPN, Deportes and the app. We're going to have game two of the Heat-Bucks Eastern Conference semifinals. That's at 6:30 Eastern. Then it's game seven between the Rockets and Thunder. Coverage tips with NBA Countdown at 6 o'clock Eastern. Welcome back to The Jump. I'm here with Zach Lowe, Amin Alhassan. Guys, Celtics-Raptors game two tips off on ESPN in about 90 minutes, so let's chat about it. Boston never trailed once in their way to an 18-point win on Sunday. The Raptors hit 10 of 40 from deep, have now lost 4 out of 5 to the Celtics, including the regular season. Zach, are you giving the Raptors a pass at all for the game one blowout?
A pass? A pass?
Well, these are the defending champions.
They're not playing the Orlando Magic from last season in the first round. You don't get a pass for this. Look, this game exposed some of the issues that people were worried about with the Raptors, right? Can they score in the half court? Because Boston has the best transition defense in the league. They're going to take away a lot of Toronto's fast break points. And 10 of 40 from three, that's going to change. Toronto's going to make shots. Game one was actually much closer than the score indicated. But no, they don't get a pass. They got to come out. This is a really good Boston team, even without Hayward. They got to come out and play really well in game two.
Yeah, I'm going to give him a pass, Rachel. I'm going to get on the phone with Adam Silver. I'm going to say, hey, game one, that one doesn't count. So now we're just playing the best of six series. Hey, no passes. It's the playoffs. Like, oh,
you guys
are
harsh.
All the excuses. They could be valid. But guess what? They're not going back on that result. No, I think
I gave
a couple
the Bucks a pass
right,
for losing to Orlando in game one of the last series. These exist. Go ahead.
But that was Orlando. They don't count. No, here's the reality. Like, what Zach said is, the Raptors struggled scoring a half court, and we saw that. Now, part of that is they missed shots that they normally make. Part of that is Pascal Siakam not in a great flow because he's in early foul trouble. I expect to see a different result today.
Do you guys expect the size issue to come back to haunt Boston at all in this series? Zach, what do you think?
Size issue? No, I think it's more likely, I think, their depth issue. Those Brad Wanamaker, Semi Ojeleye, Grant Williams, although Grant Williams has played really well, those guys that are soaking up the Gordon Hayward minutes, those are the minutes Toronto has to win with a bench that was really good, at least 8 or 9 deep for the regular season.
I mean, we got 20 seconds,
no,
yes
Marcus
or no?
Marcus Smart starting means that the bench is a little bit weaker than it should be. So, yeah, if Toronto's going to beat them, it's going to be because their bench is better.
Got it. All right, well, thank you, guys. We'll see if all your predictions come true. We'll be back tomorrow on The Jump. See you then.